This is the panel on race and ethnicity, facing our past, from 12:30 to 1:40, and it's panel number 4208. It's wonderful to have you all here. I am Kristen Carpenter. I'm on the law school faculty here at CU, where I teach property, American Indian law, and international human rights. I do a lot of work with American Indian communities throughout the United States and increasingly throughout the world. I have an appointment to the United Nations as one of seven members of the Expert Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which is a body under the Human Rights Council that's dedicated to helping countries realize the aspirations of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So that's what I'm doing when I'm not teaching law. We have a really wonderful group of speakers whom I will introduce to you just briefly so that we can get right to the conversations. As with all people of this stature, these comments hardly begin to do them justice. But to my left is Peter Light. He's a sinologist. Does anybody know what that means, by the way?
China specialist.
China expert. Somehow I didn't know that until 5 minutes ago. So he's an expert on China. Sinologist, thank you. Now retired from careers in international banking and teaching, he serves on a number of boards and also is an author of several books, Places of China, and Host of Memories, and is currently working on a book about the adoption of your daughters, if I'm reading that correctly. Thank you. To his left is Del Garcia, who's dedicated her career to meeting the healthcare needs of agricultural workers and other mobile communities. I understand that she works across borders, across international borders on migrant issues, and as a liaison between government and non-governmental organizations. To her left is Bill Thorne, whom I know by reputation, at least in the American Indian law community, as a very distinguished judge and tribal member himself, and in particular as somebody whose jurisprudence on the issues of Indian child welfare has really forged a path and elevated our community in quite a few ways. With those brief remarks, I would like to turn it over to Peter to begin the remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. Sorry about my voice. I just can't help mentioning in this distinguished company, a story comes to mind that when President Kennedy invited all the Nobel laureates to the White House for supper, he said there has never been such an assemblage of brilliance since Thomas Jefferson dined alone. it's a pleasure to be in this company. Quite frankly, I struggled with this topic because I find that current events are sort of a foil for all of my thoughts these days, and I was determined to remain credible and unhysterical as I speak about these topics because they're very important. I find it interesting that in our time, the fear of the other is ascendant, yet we are obsessed with otherness in self-examination. When I look at ancestor.com, for example, you see a man who started out thinking he was Irish, and then he discovers he was a German. So I wonder if what kind of cultural baggage goes from thinking that, well, maybe there was nobility in an IRA ancestor, and then do you turn into a brown shirt because of genetics? And I find it very confusing, and this leads me to this trouble and obsession that we have with taxonomy, which is the classification of things, and we're always it's getting more difficult to face our past by obsessively dividing ourselves upper and smaller pieces. We're doing this in real time, which might in fact take us further and further into the future, away from the history that we are obliged to confront, which is really at odds with the idea of facing the past. And it's tough for me to think about this. So I prefer to discuss the past in terms of history, which gives our divisions context. And I think when it comes to this context, we are entitled to opinions, but not facts. I think this is very important because facts now are under siege, and I won't have it. I'll have dinner with morons if I must, but there's a certain level of truth that has to be discussed and accepted and regarded as fair. And I'm perfectly willing to go the mile, because the last thing I want to do is convince people of things that they already agree with. It's a hiding to nowhere. Those are not the people who need our attention now. I think what our current situation is all about, I really believe, is that in the present, we're in the middle of a race between the last gasp of white America, sort of the Ozzie and Harriet syndrome. I hope you know what I'm talking about. I can't be the oldest one here. I just can't. Black and white, pretty funny, Ozzie and Harriet. The last gasp of America, which might never have existed, and the triumph of a new reality, which is a simple tale of demography. And I think what I want is demography to win really fast, so the last gasp is soon over. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm glad you used the word taxonomy, because when I look at race and ethnicity and I look in my own life, that, you know, on the few occasions when I've been asked to identify my race, my options have been Asian, white, and black. Not a great choice.
Show off.
Right? In any, you know, when I'm thinking of myself. And so I do select white with a great deal of, not trepidation, but like, really? Because I am not conferred any of those benefits, as I see when we start talking about those race divisions. When it comes to ethnicity, and I'm able to step forward and talk about my personal history and reflecting on my ancestors, then it goes multiple directions. You know, there is the group that lived in Texas and have more Mexican origin roots. There are those ancestors that came from Spain. I'm not sure of what the full combination is there in terms of, other than Jewish, there had to have been other things too, and what brought them. And so when I think about how I'm asked to describe my ethnicity, it is historically what has come from ancestors and what I think it represents and what I even think it really is. But then there's the practical experience of it. And so, you know, facing our past then reminds me of my parents and some of the choices that they made around what I feel are cultural elements for me. So, for example, I did not grow up speaking Spanish. I spoke no Spanish in the home other than comida y cariño, which is food and affection. Your grandparents, neither of my grandmothers spoke English. Well, my maternal grandmother spoke the worst English I'd ever heard in my whole life, but neither of them really spoke English. And so the conversations, because my parents did not teach us to speak in Spanish, were limited to those things. Did I want to eat? Did that, you know, I was very loved. And it wasn't until much later that I understood from my parents that they had grown up during a period where they were punished for speaking Spanish in school, where it had been so horrible to come into school and not understand the language in which everything that was being presented to you was being presented, and that you could not have personal conversations with your friends and your peers in a language of, you know, of ease and facility and joy. And so my parents vowed that we would not have that in our lives, that we would have every advantage that they could bring to us, and I really did, my brother did as well. We were afforded an incredible education. I was educated by Jesuits, which, if you've ever been in a class with Jesuits, there is really nothing finer than having them really say, I don't care what you believe, but you need to articulate it clearly. You need to state the facts from which this position is drawn, and then you need to be able to defend it to the death. And so that really did prepare me in a way that I'm not sure any other kind of education would have for some of the things that I have faced around race and ethnicity. And so facing the past then is thinking about my parents, those burdens that they experienced as a mechanism of their ethnicity in West Texas. And then I have to think about how it plays out for me and my own sense of place in the world. But then it also made me reflect on, and then what I pass forward to my son. And I offer just this one story. I had some friends visiting from Germany. I live in Austin, Texas. I put them in my car. My son was about 5 years old. We drove to San Antonio. And we were wandering around. We got to the Alamo. And I turned to my friends and I said, "Well, Jim Thorne, here you have it. A monument to dead white men." And my son looked at me and he goes, "But Mom, I'm a white man." My son's dad is Irish. My son is very fair. He's almost translucent. And but it was a stunning moment of what I think and how I articulate what I think affecting my son, and really caused a moment of great pause. Mm-hmm.
I'm Bill Thorne. I'm a Pomo Coast Miwok Indian from Northern California. And I served as a judge for 34 years, starting in tribal courts, and then to state trial courts, and then to state court of appeals. So that reflects what the context around what I'm going to do. But I wasn't sure what I was going to say when I got here, and I need to thank Peter, because we just had a conversation, and a light bulb went off in my mind and said, you know, that's the framework that I want to put to this conversation. And that's that acknowledging the past is important. I'm a firm believer in truth and reconciliation kind of conferences. But acknowledgement by itself is hollow. And let me give you an example from my work as a judge. I had a case where I had to sentence a young lady. 16 years old, she had knocked on the door of a woman she didn't know and stabbed her 17 times when she opened the door. She had pled guilty, and at 17, she was in the adult court system. And I had to decide what to do with her. The easy default in my state was to commit her to a term of 10 to life for the offense she committed. And it wouldn't have been up to me, it would have been up to the parole board when and if she got up. That's the easy choice. That's the one where I don't have to take any responsibility. But my roots are from the tribal court system, where restorative justice is the goal, where there are no throwaway people. Everybody is valuable. And for every soul we don't reclaim, every life we don't reclaim, that's a tragedy for the community. It's a tragedy for the families involved, but it's a tragedy because the community didn't get what that person has to offer. So I said I wanted to try and do some restorative work. And people told me, no, you can't do that. Well, for those of you who know me, that's sort of like supercharging me. So I went to the network of people I know. I got people to volunteer. I got a mediator and therapist who I trusted to volunteer to meet with the victim and the little girl. I got my constables from the courtroom to volunteer to be security so everybody was safe. I got a domestic violence therapist to be available on call for when and if the victim needed to talk to somebody. I got the prosecutor and the defense attorney to agree. So the day before the sentencing, this young woman and the victim, who was so afraid she had moved out of state to come back and talk. A little girl proceeded to explain to the woman that her friends, really her frenemies, convinced her that this woman was having an affair with her 21-year-old boyfriend. This woman was 38. She didn't have anything to do with anybody this little girl knew, but was picked at random by these frenemies. So, after hearing the story, and they talked for a couple hours, we recessed and we came to court the next morning for sentencing. And as my practice, I heard first from the prosecutors, but then from the victim. And the victim got up and advocated for the little girl, saying that she believed in second chances. And nobody at 17 should have their life decided for their worst moment, for their stupidest moment. That should not define who you are. And she was very, very articulate and very moving. And then it came time for the young woman to talk. And she had a hard time talking through her tears and her I can't really say sobbing so much as bawling. And it was clear she was sorry, but it went way beyond that. Because she explained that she had never in her life had somebody speak up for her. Ever. And she could not grasp the fact that this woman who she had hurt so badly was speaking up for her. It's like the world got turned inside out for her in those moments. Because she didn't know what the woman was going to say. I'm not sure the woman knew what she was going to say before she got there. But the world had changed so dramatically. It's like she had no points of reference anymore. Because she couldn't understand how this person could talk on her behalf and plead for her. That, I think, is the second part. Acknowledgement is the first. Empathy. Knowing what you caused and feeling what you caused is the second part. And then the third, I think, because I think that's still not enough. It's what is the continuing impact of what happened? For this woman, it helped her because, as I was explaining to Peter just a moment ago, this was no longer a random act. She didn't have to be afraid of shadows anymore. That out of nowhere, this violence just descended on her. There was a reason. It was a stupid reason. But there were human reasons behind what happened to her. And it was no longer random. And she could pull her life together and go on because of that. And for this little girl, for the first time, she saw somebody care against all reason for her. That's her first experience with that. And so I trace that back then to the fact that in our prisons, one of the highest correlates of people in prison, there are two that I want to talk about. One of them is lack of empathy. You're not aware of the harm that you caused. I took your car. It's just a car. But I took your car and I disrupted your life for weeks, including getting to your mother's funeral, getting to the birth of your child, whatever it was. There are human impacts from actions. It's not just things. So lack of empathy. And the other correlate is a huge majority of people in prison came out of the foster care system. If you put those two together, how do we learn empathy? We learn from people who cared about us, from people we admired, we saw they care about other people. That ability to look beyond yourself and look beyond your own motives. How do you do that if you've never had that? In foster care, how do you get that if you've never grown up with people who care about you? Who you believe take care of you and feed you only because somebody's paying them. So even if you have saints for foster parents, the perspective of the kid is, you're doing it because you're being paid. So try and tie that circle back to racism and acknowledging the past. I think part of acknowledging the past is, what is the continuing impact of what happened? It's not enough to acknowledge that slavery was wrong. What are the things that have happened since then that continue to impact the lives of those people? In Indian country, it's not enough to acknowledge that there was a pattern of eradication. There's also 150 years of taking children away from their families intentionally to disrupt families in the name of so-called helping. And do we understand that that 150 years of policy has implications today in how dysfunctional life is on a lot of reservations and in a lot of Indian families? If we understand that impact, then I think we can take the steps to healing. Back to the restorative justice notion. You have to acknowledge what happened. You have to understand what the impact of it was. And then you can begin the healing. So let me stop there. Thank you.
Thank you all for these powerful remarks. I appreciate them. And I appreciate how you really took the topic of race and ethnicity facing our past and addressed it in a very rich way. I was, to be totally honest, a little resistant about the title, because I think for many of us, race and ethnicity aren't squarely located in the past. They're lived experiences, aspects of our daily lives. And I, you know, just to reflect a little bit, the taxonomy question and the potential reductionist aspect of identities based around race and identity are certainly worth reflecting on, as, of course, is ongoing discrimination based on those categories. But I appreciate, too, and I think Bill's comments reminded me that from our racial and ethnic and other spheres of identity, there's a lot of powerful cultural knowledge that can be brought to address contemporary problems. And some of that acknowledgement has to do with justice and healing, perhaps that can address some of those divisions that the taxonomies alone and their function in our history have caused. We'd like to bring in the audience, community members, and you all may already know the drill here, but I'll read my note, which says I should read this at the beginning of the Q&A. So in this CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. So to ask a question in the app, and I've already received at least one or two, simply tap Q&A and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand to ask for a note card from one of the producers. Please write legibly, and if you're a student, please so indicate. So with that, I welcome your thoughts and sending questions in one way or another. If I can start with the first one. Yeah, of course. Sure.
Sorry, I can't help myself. Yeah. when Bill mentioned the car, I couldn't help but think of the futurist who spoke here a few days ago, who only talked about cars, which I found really odd. It was like half the talk or a third of the talk, because he only talked about machines and didn't say boo about people. And I'd like to hear a futurist talk about what's waiting for us, and not simply volts to the gallon or whatever you call it, I don't know. I'd also like to just mention the social media in terms of all of these issues. It's inescapable. And the velocity of social media, in a funny way, constantly alienates us from the issues that we should be addressing because of the velocity of it. It's extraordinary. Just one other thing. I sort of, without looking to history or Amazon or any .com stuff, I am the member of a two-father family with two Chinese daughters who actually got bas mitzvahed in Beijing. So top that. But I live this all the time, and I live with the unexpected lives that they're living, and I really have to buckle up in the present.
Would any other panelists like to further comment before I bring in the audience questions?
And I appreciate your statement as well, Bill, because you talked about the randomness of the act. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the defensiveness that I carry with me always is because those interactions that I either presume are based on my ethnicity or I know are based on it because the words were very clear, leave you with that sense that it is at any moment that things can go awry. And so you want, you know, we hear all of the stuff that comes out of you know, religion and spirituality and, you know, lead with an open heart. And that is certainly what I would like to do every day. It is, you know, is certainly how I wake up in the morning. But I think that I don't know if I've passed the point of no return, but there is always that just that low level sense of shaky belly that at any moment something is going to come out of at me unexpectedly, even if I don't want to stand there.
And I think that's one of the impacts that I was talking about from history is if you go through the day aware of who you are and what that may cause, or if you go through the day unaware of who you are and live life as it is, that's the approach that's different for a large number of people who don't fit the majority definition.
The questions are coming in and they're really tough ones, so Godspeed.
But so Bill's going first.
Given that these are such huge topics, don't feel that you have to answer them definitively, and hopefully we can get through a number of these. But the first one's a doozy. Is there any definition of race that you see as meaningful today? And you don't all have to answer, but if anybody would like to take that one on.
But somebody does.
I think race in the anthropological sense or the physiological sense doesn't make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But I think race in the sense that it's a category or a pigeonhole we put other people continues to make sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's not to say it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But I think that action that we do to put people in boxes and put a label on them facilitates our ease of living our life. And I think humans are, I don't know if it's just susceptible or if it's an ingrained part, but what we have to begin to do is understand and the empathy and the acknowledgement of what happened. There's a reason behind whatever action we want to complain about. If we look to that, if we understand the reason, we're halfway to the solution.
I'm addicted to NPR, forgive me, but I recently heard a program on scientific discoveries that are going on now, that the color of skin is really irrelevant to the development of races. So I thought, wow, that's really good news. So what are the races going to do about this? They're going to deny facts, and they're going to deny science. which I find very dispiriting. So we must plow ahead with an intrepid spirit to educate people and continue to believe in the truth and in science. But wouldn't it be wonderful if the whole concept of racial otherness based on simple color of skin meant nothing?
And yet, speaking of color of skin, though, and that it doesn't mean anything, I think the lived experience of color means so much. Even within our own families. I mean, the nickname that I carried when I was a kid was India, because I had blonde hair and blue-eyed cousins, and they were güero. And so, you know, then you go out into the world, and there's gradations, and there's this profile, and, you know, that. But then there's this hair. And so I think that yes, the science behind it, and the fact that perhaps those categories don't specifically or truly mean anything would be something to be embraced and would be wonderful. And yet I think it's so outside of the lived day-to-day experience, I'm challenged to see how that will happen.
And I think the only people who are privileged enough to be colorblind are the ones who don't have to live the consequences.
Amen to that. Okay, moving right along to further difficult questions. This is from a student. On the note of fearing other, in quotes, while obsessing over the other within, what are your thoughts about cultural appropriation?
So if I like hamburgers and french fries, am I appropriating?
Appropriation, I think, is almost a part of being an American. I mean, while there's aspects of the melting pot I don't believe in, there are aspects that are so subtle. I mean, think about our diet now. How many different kinds of food do we like? Is that appropriation or is that appreciation? If we look at the native views about family or about the environment, is that appropriation or is that appreciation? There's certainly a fuzzy line that you can walk down where that gets to be very hard. I mean, just recently there was a newspaper story about a fraternity who, in their multicultural day at the university, the fraternity dressed up in gang attire with a couple in blackface. I think that goes past the appreciation part. But where it is, I don't know. I mean, that's up for discussion. I think one of the nice things is you can learn from other people. What I was taught early was not to accept anything that somebody told you without some critical thought. And then I would take pieces of ideas from one theory and actions from somebody else and say, for me, those make sense. I'm going to make them part of me. Now, is that appropriation? Or is that inventing who I am going to be? I think that's a hard line. So I don't want to say don't take things from other people that are valuable. We can all learn. And if we learn from each other, maybe some of those boxes will start to fade.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. Because I think, you know, sort of one of the most recent conversations I've had with friends was around Día de los Muertos, which stood up very large in my family. It was an opportunity to reflect on our ancestors. And the building of an altar, not as a sort of a religious setting, but as a place where the photographs, the images of those ancestors were placed with a thought of honoring them, not that you don't do it all the time, but that we could specifically that day and reflect on that it is through them that we continue some stuff. And the position of a friend of mine was, yes, but I think what most people know, oh, don't leave.
Oh, stay. Stay. Please stay. You can stay.
Oh, yeah. Babies. Oh, yeah. I'll hold her.
Making a lot of sense.
You know? But that you know, my friend's experience of it was that, you know, in popular culture and in the press and everything, it was just a great day to drink a lot of tequila and paint your face like a calavera. And so, and that is appropriation as far as I'm concerned. So it was very interesting that you were able, that you gave me the words for it in terms of truly, if you appreciate it, then yes, absolutely. Because I think a mechanism to honor our dead is not always available to us. A mechanism to reflect on where we come from is not always available to us. And I think that that piece for me is a wonderful thing to share. And I love tequila, but this is not the thing that we're talking about.
I'm extremely proud of my younger daughter, who is ferocious, forever wagging her finger in my face about microaggression and cultural appropriation. And I try to explain to her that the term cultural appropriation is by definition negative. It insinuates that there is... It's a nasty business, and you're robbing somebody of something, taking something away. And I really must insist that some other term needs to be found that includes respect and admiration. It just tells half the story.
Actually, I think there's another aspect of cultural appropriation, which is taking things away, which is what the boarding schools attempted to do in tribal communities. Taking the language, taking the religion, taking the culture away. Mm. That kind of appropriation.
It's bad. Horrific.
This is actually a subject that I do a lot of work on in my own scholarship and advocacy. And the term appropriation, that's right, it's a property law term. It has to do with the non-consensual taking. Mm-hmm. And in many instances, that's what's going on, that people who are empowered... are taking because they can a resource, whether it's tangible or intangible, from a disempowered group that doesn't have the means to protect it. There are other kinds of cultural exchange that could be borrowing or dialogue or sharing, but when it is appropriation, it's appropriate to call it appropriation, I think, because that requires some acknowledgement and some remedy, like other takings also do. And I think, I mean, for me, the power dynamic, the circumstances are often the determining factor. If you have a meaningful set of exchanges among cultural groups, that's great. If you don't know enough about the group that you're interested in to know whether or not it's appropriate to participate or perform their religious ceremonies, that's not great. And I think we put that perhaps over the line. Okay, a few more questions here. I think I'm going to go to one of the handwritten ones in case that came in a little bit more slowly. Okay, so close to home. Universities are historically spaces where underrepresented people are... Universities historically are spaces where underrepresented people are marginalized even further. And to Dell's point, to push back or even reverse historical narratives requires a lot of courage. Will the academic community ever get to a point where history being taught to young people will reflect truth, the perspectives of those who've been squelched, or will it be too late?
The aspects of that question reflect a lot of the notion that the conqueror gets to write the history. And what I find in trying to solve problems, for example, in communities, one of the things that's important is to come to a shared understanding of what the history of this place is. So in trying to resolve community tensions in a community in California between tribal and non-tribal people, it was important that they create a shared history. That doesn't mean they shared the history, but that the place had a history for both of the groups. And it was important that each understand the history of the other as a first step, again, toward trying to work together. That's that, acknowledgement and impact again. Whether universities will ever get to that place, I mean, I guess one of the steps would be to involve communities as part of that. Because if your credentials for being at the university are that you survived a university for multiple years to get graduate degrees, you sort of create a self-fulfilling prophecy. But if a part of the university is to bring in community, I think then maybe you begin that process.
But I think what we need to add to that, because I agree, is looking at how education is financed. I mean, there's an expression in Spanish, el que paga manda, the one who pays decides. And so much of education is funded through philanthropy, and the desires of the philanthropist, of the giver, are manifest in how things are presented at the school and what are the educational lessons that are perpetrated. And that control can be perpetuated for a very long time. So I think the other thing that we need to look at is if we want education to be done differently, we need to finance education differently.
I've had a very visual example of this. At my university, there are reunions every year, and all of the classes parade, and there are bands, and it's very jolly, and banners, and all this kind of stuff. And up until the 60s, you might see a Chinese guy. Certainly, no Jews, but that's not apparent. And then suddenly, as the 60s come, there's an occasional black student, and then the women come. And then after mid-70s, the place is unrecognizable in terms of what came before. And I think that speaks volumes in terms of effort and decency. It's not perfect. And I refuse to be cynical about hope.
Thank you all. This is an interesting one. So race, this is a conversation happening more and more here in the U.S., but this bad behavior is present in other countries and cultures. Is anyone doing it well, or that can serve as a model for the future here and elsewhere? And I guess just to, you know, add one term to this question, we have largely had a domestic U.S.-focused conversation. Could we internationalize and think about these issues in a global context?
I don't know enough to have any informed opinion.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, I do a lot of international travel, and I think that there is always in evidence some division for power. In many places, it's economic, but there is that racial ethnic divide that has, from my perspective, at its core, trying to establish power and trying to maintain power. And so it feels like I think about South Africa, I think about Central America, where it's indigenous folks and that I don't have an experience that I can point to right away, but that what seems it's that racial is a proxy for power, or it is power. It is how power is decided, and it is what is then used to maintain it. And I think that I don't have good examples of it breaking out that I can think of. Do you?
I lived abroad for almost 3 decades, split between England, China, and Japan and Hong Kong. And interestingly, in the countries that are most racially, ethnically homogeneous are the ones who are most terrified of otherness. So the Chinese are, I think, 96% Han, and the Japanese are 110% Japanese, and they are petrified peoples. England is a lot more complicated. Ironically, I found it more difficult and puzzling to live in England than I did in China. And that's because of the rules, the infinite rules that wait in ambush. but I don't think anybody does it well.
If you'll forgive me, I'll offer one frame from the United Nations context, and that's a human rights frame. So the United States, we usually talk about race and racial discrimination. I think the ascendant model in international human rights work is one of peoples, and peoples being units of organization beyond individuals and nation states, which have historically dominated world politics. And as we conceive of and recognize peoples who have long, you know, organized as such, and perhaps terms like race, ethnicity, tribe, clan may be resonant, they may be not, and conceive of them as entities that deserve self-determination, rights to equality, rights to culture, and so on, I think there are a number of very promising models that reflect individual and collective rights in a way that does subvert some of the politics and laws of subordination that have so often infected our world and our country in particular. And just to be a little bit of a pain in the neck, it turns out that the Japanese aren't 110% Japanese. And although they've had this ethic of homogeneity, they have recently recognized the Ainu people, who are indigenous people in the Hokkaido region of Japan. And I think Asia is slowly coming to terms with actually its diversity and peoples within those nations, those, you know, nation states, to use contemporary parlance, in ways that are surprising and revealing and disruptive, but certainly interesting for this conversation.
But I think we also need to be honest in how even these discussions at levels like at the UN and statements that are made and how they're written, how they are actually then presented and lived. Because I've been in settings where we've been looking at this UN statement of peoples and the issue and the idea of equity. And what was used at one of the settings where it was being presented by someone who was in the position to know of its development was an image of a baseball game going on, and there was a fence. And on this side of it, there were four people of different height, all on the same size crate. And on this side of the fence, there was the same four people, same height, each with a crate that allowed them to then achieve the same height looking over the fence. And this was the example that was afforded for equity. But there was someone who was in the group who came from Latin America and said, yes, but from my perspective, equity would be having a seat at the baseball game. And I think that that's critical to remember.
I wouldn't get too misty about the Japanese recognizing the Ainu, because frankly, their big secret is that they're really Korean. That's another session. But also, there is the country in the world that would most benefit for inward migration is Japan, because their population is plummeting at an alarming rate. And I think the Japanese, every 50 years or 60 years, are capable of a paradigm shift. And if we see them recognize immigration, we will know that real progress has been made.
So these two questions, I think, could be addressed together. Each deserves serious attention, but I see them as related. So I'll read the first one and then the second one. Bill talked about empathy and how it is key in acknowledging the faults of the past and is necessary to help one move forward. How can we as people of color get white people to empathize with our oppressive past in order to create social change now? So that, I think, is a question from a student of color, a person of color. And then this one, as a white person of privilege, how can I support or be part of a conversation around what might be labeled as appropriation, but is one of appreciation, as Judge Thorne briefly mentioned?
I wish there was an easy answer to that, but I think it's sort of, the answer is in the journey. As you learn about people, you learn what you like and you don't like about that person. As you meet more people like that person, you learn that that person's strengths are not necessarily strengths that are attributable to what they look like, but to who they are. And as you do that more, I think you become more comfortable with that. But in terms of allies, I've come to define allies as somebody who has your voice when you're not in the room, but not somebody who will tell you what you need to do to fix the problem, who's willing to pitch in and help without needing control. So it's sort of a complicated version of an ally. But allies are essential, because if we could have done it alone, we would have. The fact that we have not succeeded means that we cannot do it alone. We need allies.
And I don't think that there is any teaching, any leading, any forcing, there just isn't, you know. And it reminds me, I mean, I'm old enough to have been young and a teenager and a college student in the, you know, 70s. And all the work when women came together to talk about the interactions with men. And then getting to the place of saying, you know what, the behavior of men is the responsibility of men. We can stand up for ourselves in terms of what it is that we require or we demand or we request or we expect, however you want to frame it for yourself. And that what you can do then is look at your own self, if that's what you choose to do, introspect and engage with people with whom you do want to be allied and not with those who do not, because the change is individual. I was screaming down the hall over at UMC, and a really lovely gentleman stepped forward in just a second, kind of blocked my path, and he said, you know, this is a silly story. And he got up and then he said, but you know, my 80-year-old dad hated Mexicans, always. I don't know why. He just always did. And then one year, I took him with me. We went down to Mexico to buy a Volkswagen, because at that time you could still buy the Beetles because they were manufactured. And he went down there, and they went down there with their tools, and they stayed in Juarez, which is just on the other side of where I grew up in El Paso. And they went over with their tools apparently every day, and they worked with this Volkswagen. And then they, at the father's demand, they packed up their tools and came back to the U.S. side because, you know, it was dangerous. And then the second day they went back. And then on the third day, they were there and they would eat their lunch standing at the back of the truck that they were in. And people were very kind and talked to them. And, you know, and did they need something to drink, and didn't they want to sit down in the shade? And the father turned to his son and said, why are these people so nice to us? And the son said, well, maybe because they're nice people. And his father, the next day, as the son was packing up the tools hurriedly, said, what are you doing? They're safer here than they are in El Paso. And so for him, and he welled up, and then I welled up. And because for him, it was this experience with a father whose behavior he could not understand, but certainly was not in a position to change, to have the experience of that behavior changing. It was beautiful. And then he kept saying, but it's a silly story. And it was like, I don't know how you tell him. No, that was one of the most beautiful things that's been said to me while I was here.
I don't think there is any reason to expect that decency is in the ether. I think parents really have to deliver the goods and make no assumptions. There's one example of something that's going on in my family. My older daughter is at a college, and there's been some political activity on her campus, and there was a black student gathering that was trying to figure out strategy or something, and she really wanted to go and help this little yellow Chinese Jewish kid, you know? And she wanted to go, and they wouldn't let her in. And whatever the reasons, I really had to deal with that in talking to her about it. And it raised some very complex issues. And I really don't have the answers. But she's wrestling with them.
Thank you all. I love this one. So for the young people in the audience, elementary, middle, and high school, how do you think these messages relate to their present and their future?
I think the more different kinds of people you get to know, the better human being you will become.
Bingo.
My kids are 9 and 11, so I'm still working on this and figuring it out for sure. And, you know, I encourage those young people because I do think it's true. And sometimes as educators and as parents, you know, I'm feeling, when I first started being a law professor, I was 28 and my students weren't very much, and now I'm not 28 anymore, obviously. And so the students seem super young. And I think, you know, hearing and they're sort of smattered through the room, I mean, this is one of those things where we probably need to listen to you all as much so we don't get stuck in our old categories and ways of thinking. As you had said earlier, as demographics change, you know, we probably need to keep up. Okay, here's another one, and it's a little bit long, but I'll read the whole thing. If racism is categorizing people for power, will getting rid of it cause a loss of power because nobody has the need to fight for a voice? Or will people compromise more readily because they feel less threatened? Or is it neither? So I guess what are the power politics at stake around racial identity?
No, I don't think that let me see how I want to go about this. Power is the order of the day. It is how people are raised here and elsewhere to achieve power, to pursue power, to maintain power. It is very rare to find groups where that is not the structure of their daily lives. I know that there are groups. I don't mean to imply that there aren't. But that if you are out sort of in the everyday world, the goal is power. And race is just one mechanism on which to divide people and shift or maintain those powers. So that I think it becomes much harder, particularly when we start looking at race and ethnicity, when we talk about immigration, because most of those power conversations are based on the notion of scarcity. There just isn't enough to go around, and if you come, you will take part of mine, and then I won't have enough. I mean, that,
or at least as much.
As much, and that I deserve to have as much as I have and to keep all that I have. And that becomes such a difficult conversation because I don't think it is a scarce environment in which we live. I think that there is considerable abundance, but that it doesn't, that abundance needs to be available to all and not concentrated so tightly. And I'm not sure then how you have that conversation. So I don't think it is just that if there is no racism, there will be no structural peace around power that then is somehow immediately erased. Did that make any sense?
What I find most frustrating is a lack of interest in power amongst the people who need it most. So when I meet someone who should be voting often and chooses not to, I really want us to thrash them. And I think now particularly, people simply must vote. It's the easiest way to get things right. Not perfect, but right.
I agree with the voting and the necessity of that. But I think I've worked hard over the last few years trying to reorient my perspective. Because I'd spent so long in the judiciary where you have the power to change people's lives. Mm-hmm. And at least for me, I recognized I didn't have the wisdom to have that much power. For me, then, it became more about creating relationships. About power is, I can make you do this, or I can make you suffer these things. And I understand that human beings have historically craved power. But I'm not sure that's a good thing. I think if instead, and I, please understand, I am one of the most cynical people you'll ever want to meet. And for me to be saying something like this is threatening to shatter my identity. But I think it's important that we start to look at richness, not as power, but as the number of important, caring relationships we have. Different people bring different richness to my life. People who I disagree with adamantly bring something to my life I didn't have, even if it's just perspective. The tribal notions of relationship being more important than your job or your title, I don't know if it's wishful thinking, but as I get older, that becomes much more important than what I can make you do.
We have 10 minutes left, and I have two great questions in front of me to engage us further. And this one pushes us a little bit further. It says, a lot of the answers have talked about the individual aspects of dealing with race, but what are the systematic challenges we can make? What are the systematic changes we can make as a nation to change our beliefs of race and the racial disparities we see in many aspects of life? And I think this question may ask us to put on our policy hats. You know, what would we like to see change to address systematic problems?
Yeah, let me use the example of education. I mean, we have education that is not race-based anymore after Brown versus Board of Education. But we have education that is clearly race-impacted. The access to quality education falls clearly in racial lines. There are certainly exceptions. But I don't see people lining up to send their suburban kids to schools in the inner city because they're such quality institutions. I see reservation schools that have 85% unemployment. I see the schools in Ferguson where they can't even get their kids into college because they're not credentialed. How do we go back to that? I think we have to get past the so-called colorblind test. And say, well, we're not making this decision because of race. I think what we have to do is look at, is our decision having a disparate impact on different groups? And if it is, the fact that I didn't mean it doesn't make it okay. What it says is, okay, I didn't mean it to be like that, but here is the impact. So how do we begin to change that? How do we begin to fix that? I think lack of racial animus is not enough.
I was born in Florida and lived there till I was 8. Thank God my parents got divorced and we moved to New York. And every morning we sang Dixie. And we were off for Jefferson Davis's birthday. I got to New York in the middle of the winter, and on that first day, my teacher told this girl, who I'm still friendly with, Nancy, take Peter downstairs and show him the snow. So she takes me down to the schoolyard, kids were playing, and I looked around and said, what are all the Negroes doing here? She just looked at me. You know, it didn't even compute. And I knew that I said something, it wasn't right or wrong, it was stupid. I just knew immediately it was stupid, and I never thought about it again. So I think environment has a tremendous effect on people. So if she had lectured me or, I mean, she was as used to her way of life as I had been to mine, and when I was plopped down in the middle of hers, my old one made no sense. And that's what we can hope for.
And I think one of the structural elements from my perspective, and not an easy one, is immigration. And the criminalization of immigration. I mean, to come here on a visa and overstay it, or to come here without a visa is referred to as a crime, but it's actually a civil offense. So you're not, and please correct me if I say anything stupid and seriously wrong, but you know, that whole notion that you're not guaranteed access to an attorney, you know, that the ability to have your day in court, and how that is now being exercised around individuals who come as refugees seeking asylum, I think it has been made, you know, sort of tantamount to taking someone's life in the way it is described and discussed. And what I would really like for us to be able to achieve is a more rational discussion of what kind of laws those are and how they're framed and what they really mean and what breaking those particular laws really amounts to and how that can be addressed. Please.
I want to say something about immigration, but that's from my own perspective as an American Indian. Most of you out here are immigrants or immigrant relatives.
You're not.
And what I am perplexed by is the notion that so many people are concerned about, I got mine, but let's not let anybody else come in after me. From my perspective, the only thing we should be asking is, are you willing to work hard? Mm-hmm. Are you willing to support your family? And are you willing to support your neighbors? If you're willing to do those three things, why are we fussing about this? I mean, the strength of what has become America is all the different perspectives that are here. And it makes no sense to me to say, I got here early enough that I don't have to pass those kinds of questions or tests. Well, for the people who got here even before you, life isn't all that good either. So why don't we, instead of fussing about who gets what, help each other?
But I find it fascinating that situational ethics seem to apply to immigration. Sometimes it's great, and sometimes it's demonized. Why is it that there's this sort of wave of acceptance and rejection over time that applies particularly to immigration? It's a wicked business. All of my antecedents came, my grandparents all came from Europe. They had to get out and came here and have a good life in America. And at one time it was right. If their timing had been wrong, they never would have gotten in.
Your comments all make me think of another lesson from the American Indian historical experience, which I think was that, you know, with the arrival, the earliest arrival of Europeans, the system of racial categorization that we now have in the United States wasn't present. And there's a whole bunch of work on identity as white and red and black and, you know, all of those categories arising. But if we were to paraphrase, and Bill's comments reminded me of this, I think in many of those earlier encounters, the question was more, can you be a good relative? Can we coexist in this place together? And maybe that's a category that could be helpful, and a relationship that could be helpful for us going forward.
To be a little more snarky, my response to people who want the wall is it's 500 years too late.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're saved by the bell. We're just out of time. I'm teasing. This has been a really wonderful, thoughtful conversation. Before we thank you and our panelists, I have one other responsibility, which is to remind you that the Conference of World Affairs is doing a crowdfunding campaign online with a goal to raise $70,000. We're a quarter of the way there. Please give by pressing donate so that we can continue to have more conversations like this. Thank you to all of you, and especially to our panelists.
Thank you.